Well, every day I'm in my office, I can look out across the street and I can see the sign in the window of Creston Market. You know the sign I'm talking about, right? It's the sign that gives everyone in the neighborhood hope. It shows the latest lottery winnings that are available, right? Just, it's money just waiting to be won. So you go in there, I don't know how much a lottery ticket, 20 bucks or whatever. I have no idea. But you buy a lottery ticket and you can win, I think it's $136 million this morning. You could get some air conditioning with that. I've been fascinated for years with this idea of people in their lives after they come into sudden wealth, whether it's someone who wins a lottery or also professional athletes, right? They come into sudden wealth, right? It's not often that we hear about a multimillionaire who wins $100 million in the lottery. It's not often that we hear about a millionaire who graduates from college and then is drafted and signs a multimillion dollar contract with a professional team. It's usually the opposite story. It's the kid who grows up poor who wins a lottery, or it's the kid who grows up poor who becomes the professional athlete and suddenly has more wealth than he's actually prepared to deal with. See, the statistics show that most professional athletes are completely broke within 5 years after they quit playing their sport. 5 years. Antoine Walker is perhaps one of the most famous. He earned $108 million over 12 seasons playing basketball. That was back when $108 million was real money. Today, he's broke. He's debt-free after his bankruptcy, but he is completely broke. See, many will point to his lavish lifestyle as the reason he no longer has $108 million. And he'll admit that that was part of it. He loved buying houses. He loved buying fancy cars. And he really loved going out to expensive restaurants with the team. And whenever he was with the team, he insisted on paying for everyone's meals. It's not hard to see how he quickly go through $108 million. But he will tell you that that's not actually the reason he is broke today. He said during the 12 years he played professional basketball, he was, in his words, an open ATM machine. See, he'll tell you about all the millions that he gave away to friends as he tried to help his friends have a better life, usually in the form of starting some business that was poorly thought through. That's what I find so fascinating about those who become suddenly rich, right? Over the years, I've read a number of stories, those who become instant millionaires and then lose it very quickly. And one of the common complaints that comes from them is that their friends change. Now, their friends typically accuse the lottery winner of changing, but the common thread in a lot of these stories is that it's actually the friends of the lottery winner who change. For example, in the words of one of the lottery winners I read about, he said, look, if I go out to eat with my friends every Friday night for 20 years and we each pay for our own meal, then I win the lottery and suddenly my friends are telling me that I changed because I'm not paying for their meal. Like, who really changed? I never paid for the meal for 20 years. But now they're expecting me to. One of us did change, but it's the expectation of the friends that changed. See, wealth is a dangerous thing because it can cause us to lose sight of what really matters. This is what we see in the book of Exodus. This is what happened with Israel and the golden calf. If you would turn with me to Exodus chapter 33. We looked at the incident of the golden calf last week, but this week's text is a continuance of what happened last week. Exodus 33, verse 1. Yahweh said to Moses, depart, go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt, to the land of which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, to your offspring I will give it. I will send an angel before you, and I will drive out the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go up among you, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people. When the people heard this disastrous word, they mourned, and no one put on his ornaments. For Yahweh had said to Moses, say to the people of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. If for a moment, a single moment, I should go up among you, I would consume you. So now take off your ornaments, that I may know what to do with you. Therefore the people of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments from Mount Horeb onward. Now Moses used to take the tent and pitch it outside the camp, far off from the camp, and he called it the tent of meeting. And everyone who sought Yahweh would go out to the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. Whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people would rise up and each would stand at his tent door and watch Moses until he had gone into the tent. When Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent, and Yahweh would speak with Moses. And when all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, all the people would rise up and worship, each at his tent door. Thus Yahweh used to speak to Moses face to face, as a man speaks to his friend. When Moses turned again into the camp, his assistant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the tent. Moses said to Yahweh, "See, you say to me, 'Bring up this people,' but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, 'I know you by name,' and you have also found favor in my sight. Now therefore, if I have found favor in your sight, please show me now your ways, that I may know you in order to find favor in your sight. Consider too that this nation is your people." And he said, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." And he said to him, "If your presence will not go with me, do not bring us up from here. For how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not in your going with us, so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth?" And Yahweh said to Moses, "This very thing that you have spoken I will do, for you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name." At the end of chapter 32, thousands of people died as a result of the plague. This was after the 3,000 people who were killed by the Levites. Remember, the Levites were commanded to go through the camp with a sword and strike down people. God sent a plague on them, and many more died. If you recall, God's covenant was with the entire nation. And so he was perfectly right in destroying the entire nation for the sin of the nation. Even though not every Israelite participated in worshiping the golden calf, God was good and right to destroy the entire nation because the covenant was with the entire nation. And yet, God promised Moses that he wouldn't destroy the entire nation. He would only destroy those who were guilty. So it's likely that the plague took a few months to run its course. It's most likely that it was some form of disease. The disease spreads throughout the camp. Those who were guilty died. Sometime after it ended, God told Moses to get up and to depart from the mountain and head into the promised land. They would have been at the base of Mount Sinai camping after they left Egypt for about 10 months. Again, God refers to Israel as the people whom Moses brought up out of the land of Egypt. He says Moses is to take those same people and take them to the land that God promised to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, specifically to their offspring, when he promised to give it to their offspring. And then in verse 2, he promises to send an angel before them in order to drive out the inhabitants of the land. They are to go up into this land, this promised land, and he says it's a land flowing with milk and honey. This means it is a prosperous land. Right? To flow with milk and honey is to provide for Israel so abundantly that they will be living the high life. Right? It's the equivalent today of fancy cars and of big houses and expensive restaurants. It's flowing with these good things. At the end of verse 3, he says he won't go with them so that he won't destroy them because they are a stiff-necked people. Now, no doubt when they heard that, it stings. I mean, that's not a nice thing to say. But consider what God has said he will do for them. He will send an angel. This time it's an ordinary angel. He will send an angel to them who will drive out the people of the land. This means that the battle belongs to God. God's angel is going to do most of the fighting for them. They may still have to put on their weapon or grab their weapons and actually go into battle. But God is going to do the fighting. Right? God is going to send his angel who is going to drive out these people. And when they get there, they're going to occupy land, and that land that is very, very prosperous. Remember, this land is going to flow with milk and honey. Now keep in mind, they don't need milk and honey in order to survive. Right? These aren't essentials for living. They have the essentials. Milk and honey are extras. It's meant to enrich their lives. God is going to bless them with so much material prosperity, the metaphor is, that they're going to swim in it. The land is going to flow with these things. That's the idea. All they have to do is get up and go. I mean, sure, God isn't going to be there, but they still get to go into a land that is incredibly prosperous, that is just going to be an amazing place to live. In verse 4, we're told that the people mourned when they heard this disastrous word. think of what God just said. They're going to live in a land of incredible prosperity. His angel will go before them to drive out the people of the land for them. That means they're going to move into houses they did not build. They're going to harvest crops they did not plant. They're going to plant fields they did not clear. They're going to travel roads they did not construct. They're going to drink from wells they didn't dig. They're going to use barns that they didn't build. I mean, can you imagine what kind of life that was for them? Just walk in and have all this stuff just waiting for them, ready to go? Well, Israel couldn't imagine it. They said it was a disastrous word. Now think of what they've already heard from Yahweh. Chapter 32, God told Moses that he would wipe out every single Israelite who didn't come from Moses. That is, if you're an Israelite and you don't refer to Moses and his wife Zipporah as mom and dad, you're going to die. God's going to repopulate the nation with the Mosesites. Moses and his family are going to repopulate God's people. That's not the disastrous word. That sounds pretty disastrous to me, but that's not what they're referring to when they're mourning over this disastrous word. The disastrous word is that God is going to give Israel an incredible amount of material prosperity, but his presence would not go among them. When the people heard this disastrous word, they mourned, they grieved, it tore them up inside. They still had the promise of wealth and prosperity. They still had the promise of the good life. They were still promised what many today would refer to as the abundant life. And yet they mourned because Yahweh would not go with them. In verse 5, God instructs Moses to tell Israel that they're a stiff-necked people. He says, if for a single moment he were to go among them, he would consume them. He would destroy them because he is holy and they are not. Therefore, he says, they must take off their ornaments so that Yahweh may know what to do with them. Now, their ornaments included jewelry, but also fancy clothes. Like, they're dressed up. Remember how they came out of Egypt? They're dressed up, right? They had been slaves for hundreds of years, which meant they lived in abject poverty, a truly subsistence living. They didn't have nice things. When they left Egypt, they asked the Egyptians for nice things, gold and silver jewelry and clothing, and the Egyptians gave them to them gladly, willingly. Take this and go. We don't want any more of your trouble. Just take all of our good stuff, stuff really that you've earned over the last 400 years. Just take it and go. And I'm all the way back in chapter 3 of the book of Exodus, God made this incredible promise to them. Listen to these words. He said, I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and when you go, you shall not go empty. But each woman shall ask of her neighbor, and any woman who lives in her house, for silver and gold jewelry and for clothing. You shall put them on your sons and on your daughters. So you shall plunder the Egyptians. The tenderness in this promise is staggering to me. I mean, the promise that they're going to take all this riches, these nice things, and put them on their children. I mean, what father doesn't want to give nice things to his kids? I don't mean whatever your kid wants. He or eat all the candy he could possibly have. But what father doesn't truly want to bless his children with nice things? You know, there have been times in my life that my wife and I have been unable to give things to our children, things that we wanted to give to them. That's really, I don't mean, again, just another toy, right? You got a box full of them, you need one. I just, the things that we know they would love and they would cherish and they would truly delight in. That is far more difficult as a parent. To not be able to give nice things to your kid than it is for you as a parent to not have nice things. Those of you who are parents who have gone through something similar, you'll understand the wonder of God's gift to the Israelites. So God promised the Israelites that after centuries of being slaves, after centuries of living in abject poverty, that when they left Egypt, they would leave with nice things to give to their children. Things more than they could ever want. The problem is, the Israelites failed to remember that what is even greater than the good gifts God gives is the giver of those good gifts. This is why they made a golden calf. They forgot. See, when they approached Aaron, they said, Aaron, make us gods who will go before us. Go where before them? Make us gods who will go before us into the good land that God promised to give us that was filled with all these good things that we want to enjoy. God responds to this by essentially saying, look, you want my blessings, you want my good gifts, but you don't want me. Fine. I'll give you what you want. I'll send you into the land. I'll drive out the people. You'll have all that nice stuff that I promised, but I ain't going with you. And then he tells them to strip off their ornaments that he may know what to do with them. Now, in the ancient Near Eastern world, mourning was more of a physical thing than just an attitudinal thing, right? For us, when you're mourning, it's an attitude that you have. It's a posture. It's not what you're wearing. It's not a physical thing. See, in our culture, you can be mourning. A woman could be in mourning while wearing a fancy dress and jewelry and having makeup on and her jewelry and her nails done and all that, right? You see it all the time at funerals. People dress up for funerals. You can tell she's mourning because her face is downcast. She's not yucking it up in laughter with everyone. It's her attitude that is mourning. In the ancient Near East, nice clothing and jewelry, dressing yourself up, that was a sign of joy, of lightheartedness, not a sign of mourning. You couldn't be mourning if you're wearing your nicest clothes. You dressed like you were in mourning. To take off their ornaments was to demonstrate that they were in mourning over this disastrous word they heard. In verse 6, we're told that they stripped off their ornaments from Mount Horeb onward. Horeb is another name for Sinai. They're interchangeable. And once again, we see God's mercy. When God tells them to strip off their ornaments, we see God's mercy. See, he wants to see how they're going to respond to him. Actually, he knows how they're going to respond. He wants to demonstrate why he's going to respond the way he responds to their response to this disastrous word. Notice what he says in verse 5. They are to take off their ornaments that I may know what to do with you. This is just what we saw in last chapter, right? Last week. God tells Moses, step back from me so I can destroy Israel. He doesn't need Moses to step back so he can destroy Israel. He can just destroy Israel. But by telling him to step back, he's inviting Moses to intercede. He's providing Moses the opportunity to do something. When God tells Israel to strip off their ornaments, he's inviting them to participate in something, and that is a national repentance. They are to mourn the disastrous word and demonstrate their sorrow, their incredible deep sorrow at failing to keep the covenant. When he says they stripped off their ornaments from Mount Horeb onward, he means they took them off and they remained in that state, right? This wasn't a just, hey guys, let's spend the afternoon and look the part. This is a permanent acknowledgement that they have failed the covenant and that every step further that they were to take with Yahweh was an incredible blessing, an act of God's grace given to them. So Israel is expressing genuine sorrow at the disastrous word they heard. And in verses 7 through 11, we have a bit of an excursus, right? A sidebar, some editorial content that is kind of stuck in the middle of the story, but it's stuck there so that we understand the rest of the story. That's why it's important. It tells us Moses used to pitch a tent outside the camp. That just means outside where Israel is gathered around the mountain. They have their tents set up by tribe. It's an orderly arrangement. Outside of that group of tents, Moses sets up the tent of meeting. All Israel would watch as he'd walk into the tent. Remember the pillar of cloud that by day? It would descend on the tent, indicating that Yahweh was in the tent with Moses. It's very clear. He would talk to Moses face to face, just like you and I talk face to face. There is no other person in history where God is said to speak with someone face to face the way he's speaking with Moses. So Moses went out to that tent. He began to speak with Yahweh, and he says, look, you've told me to bring the people into the promised land, but you haven't told me whom you're going to send with us. But he did, didn't he? Didn't God already tell Moses whom he was sending with Moses? I mean, in verse 2, God says, I'm going to send an angel before you. And didn't he say that earlier? It was back in chapter 23. God told all Israel, I'm going to send my angel before you, and he's going to drive out the people of the land, and it's going to be good news. Right? In chapter 23, it was good news that he would send his angel before them. But in chapter 33, when he says he's going to send his angel, it's disastrous news. What changed? In chapter 23, the identity of the angel was clear. Remember, he said, if you are careful to obey my angel's voice and do all that I say, He said, my angel will bless your bread and your water, and I will take your sickness away. He said, my angel will bring you to the land, and I will drive out the people. See, God isn't tag-teaming with an angel in chapter 23. He's using language that helps Israel understand something that they're not yet prepared to truly understand. The Son of God, long before he became human, right? Because no man has seen the Father. So when Israel sees the visible manifestation of God, who are they seeing? They're seeing the Son of God. Can't see the Spirit. He's Spirit. By definition, he's not visible. So they see the Son of God, long before he became human, is going to go before Israel, and he's going to protect them, and he's going to drive out the inhabitants of the land. They must carefully obey his voice, because his voice is the voice of Yahweh. The messenger, that's what angel means, the messenger in chapter 23 is none other than the Son of God. One day he will become one of them, he will be born to a virgin, and when he comes he will be named Jesus, whose name means Yahweh saves. He is Yahweh. See, in chapter 23, Moses and Israel were comforted by the news that God would send this angel before them. But in chapter 33, Moses is completely distraught. The difference is, in chapter 33, it's clear the angel is just a plain old angel. It's not Yahweh. He's just a messenger. Moses is distraught because he recognizes this. I will send an angel before you, but I will not go up among you. He recognizes that when Yahweh says in chapter 33 that he will send an angel, the angel isn't him. Moses said, look, you tell me to take the people to the land you promised, but you haven't told me whom you will send. And he goes further. He says, look, you tell me, you know me by name, right? I go to the tent of meeting and we talk face to face. You tell me, you know me by name, that we're in this incredibly unique relationship. You tell me we're on good terms, that I have found favor in your sight. How can these things be true if I don't even know who's going before us? It ain't you, so I don't know who it is. How can these things be true? How can it be true that God favors Moses and Israel, and yet he won't go with them into the land? Notice what he says in verse 13. He says, if it's true that I have found favor in your sight, please show me now your ways. Oh yeah, and don't forget that these people are actually your people, not my people. Moses asked God to show him his ways. He's saying, look, I want to know who you are. I want to know what you're like. I want to know what really makes you tick, God. I want to know everything there is to know about you. Now think of where we've been in Exodus, right? Yahweh shows up in Egypt and he promises to rescue the Israelites out of slavery. He promises to take them to the land that he promised to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he does exactly that. He brings judgment on Egypt. He rescues them out of the land. He parts the Red Sea. He gives them fresh water to drink. He gives them manna to eat. He made a covenant with them, a covenant that he made with no other people on earth. And even though they broke the covenant on their honeymoon, God promises to not destroy them. In fact, not only will he not destroy them, he will still send them into the land flowing with milk and honey, the land of incredible blessings and prosperity. But he won't go with them. Moses recognizes the disaster that this is, and he asks God to show him what God is really like. This is what God has been doing the entire time. He's been showing what he is really like. The reason God made a promise to Abraham was to show the world what he is like. The reason God called Moses to lead Israel out of Egypt was to show the world what he is like. The reason God brought judgment on Egypt was to show the world what he is like. The reason God provided fresh water and manna to eat was to show the world what he is like. The reason God gave them a tabernacle and the system of sacrifices was to show the world what he is like. The reason God gave them the law was to show the world what he is like. God has been doing everything in his power to show the world what he's like. Listen, if you want a prayer that you can be guaranteed will be answered, I don't care who you are, if you ask God this, he will answer it. God, show me what you're like. I'll warn you, though, you may not like the answer. Because God is holy and we are not. God is infinitely wise and we are not. God is all-knowing and we are not. His ways are so much higher than our ways that if he were to show us a glimpse of what he knows, we wouldn't comprehend it. It wouldn't make any sense to us. If he showed us the beginning, we couldn't see the end. And if he showed us the end, we wouldn't know how we got there. He's too big and too vast for us. God will answer that question, and we may not like the answer, but I promise you this. The answer is always good, because God is always good. So if you ask God to show you what he is like, he will show you that he is good. Moses asked God to show Moses what God is like. Verse 14. My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. Remember the request here. God, show me what you're really like. Show me who you are. Show me what sort of God you really are. Remember the immediate context. Israel cheated on Yahweh on their honeymoon. You can't get any worse than this. They receive the covenant. Shortly after Moses goes up the mountain, they think he's taking too long. They're, you know, making a golden calf, claiming that the golden calf they just made is the God who brought them out of Egypt, which by extension is the God who has promised them all of the blessings of prosperity. And therefore, this golden calf is the one who can give them the prosperity. God tells them he will still bless them by sending them into the land of prosperity, but he won't go with them. And Moses says, all right, show me what you're really like. I get that you're holy. Show me what you're really like. And God says, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. You know, one thing is clear in this. God is holy. 3,000 died immediately because of the sin of worshiping the calf. Then thousands more died from a plague because of the sin of worshiping the golden calf. God is holy, and his holy is not to be messed with. We don't test him in his holiness. But another thing is incredibly clear in this. God is merciful. God is incredibly patient. He is kind. He is long-suffering. And he is gracious. He's still holy, so don't test him. But he's merciful. In response to God's declaration of his mercy, which is what this is, Moses gushes about his fears and his insecurities. He just opens up and spills it on God. Verse 15, he tells God that if God won't be present with him, leave him there at the mountain. There's no point in going into the land of blessing, the land of prosperity, without God. If you don't go with us, God, the blessings don't matter. Who gives a rip about milk and honey if we don't have Yahweh? He tells God that no one would know they have favor in God's sight without God's presence among them. And in verse 16, he declares what it is that makes Israel unique, distinct from all other nations. It's not the law. Only Israel had the law. It's not the food restrictions. It's not even the Sabbath. No other nation on earth had the Sabbath. They had no concept of a weekly Sabbath. What makes Israel unique is this. Is it not in your going with us so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth? He's saying that what makes Israel stand out from all other nations isn't the blessings that God gives. I mean, after all, God makes the rain fall on the just and on the unjust. The psalmist frequently wonders why the wicked prosper, right? Lots of bad people are very, very wealthy. Wealth is no sign of God's real blessing. Just because someone has money doesn't mean they're blessed by God if they don't have God. And just because someone is in poverty doesn't mean that they aren't being blessed by God. What makes Israel distinct is the presence of Yahweh among them. God hears Moses. He hears him gushing out these insecurities. And in verse 17, he declares in no uncertain terms, this very thing that you have spoken, I will do. For you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name. You know, the story of the Bible begins with the presence of God on earth, walking in a garden with people he created in his image. The Bible actually ends with the story of God walking on earth in a garden with people he created in his image. The story should be an unbroken story of God on earth walking with his people. But as you know, the story of the Bible is a very broken story, and it's filled with all kinds of brokenness. Sometime after creating people in his image, they rebelled against him, rejecting him as God. Remember, God had given Adam and Eve one rule, and the purpose of this one rule was an act of grace. It was gracious to give them this one rule. By having this one restriction, eat from any tree, but don't eat from this tree. By having this one rule, they would always be reminded that he is God and they are not. God had given them all other trees for food, thousands upon thousands of fruit trees with one restriction. The world was literally theirs, save for this one tree. And even though God had given them these gifts, they weren't satisfied with these gifts. They weren't supposed to be satisfied with these gifts. They were supposed to be satisfied in him. But when we aren't satisfied with him, then no amount of stuff will ever satisfy us. Once your satisfaction is no longer in God, it doesn't matter how much you have. It's never going to be enough. It was Rockefeller, who at the time was the richest man in America. He was asked, how much is enough? A little bit more. Just a little bit more. Ever hear of a guy named Solomon? Probably the wealthiest man in history. When you compare gold prices to today and what, how many billions, hundreds of billions that'd be, probably the richest man in history. He literally spent his entire wealth trying to prove that riches cannot satisfy. Adam rebelled against God and he ate the fruit. Eating the fruit broke the relationship. It's not the fruit, it's the act of rebellion against God. It broke the relationship. So Adam and his wife are now sinful. And because God is holy, he cast them out of the garden. But he didn't do this before showing them that he had a plan. See, God's about to kick them out. And the verb used in the text is pretty violent. God cast them out of the garden. It's like he drop kicks them out, right? It's an aggressive expression. But before he did that, he showed them that he had a plan to ensure that one day he would be back on the same planet walking with those same people after he had fixed everything. He killed some animals and covered their nakedness with his sacrifice. This is what happened with Israel. God gave them good gifts, including vast wealth. This wealth was meant to be a blessing, but somehow the blessing wasn't enough, so they wanted more. Because when the thing that you're given becomes the thing you pursue, it will never be enough. They were impatient waiting for God to lead them into the land. And so they took the very gifts that God had given them, and they made a golden calf. I mean, think of it. Where do they get the gold to make the golden calf? They gathered their earrings. Where did they get the earrings? They were slaves. Before they left, they asked their neighbors, hey, you have any gold and silver jewelry? The very gift God had given them, they were using in rebellion against him. They made a golden calf. They worshipped it. They claimed it brought them out of Egypt, and therefore it had been the one to bless them with the nice things they enjoyed. See, they weren't supposed to be satisfied with the gold and the silver and the clothing. They weren't supposed to be satisfied with the stuff. They're supposed to be satisfied with our God. Even though Israel rebelled against God in this way, God gave them a reminder that he had a plan to ensure that one day he would actually walk on earth with them forever. Their system of sacrifices both pointed back to what he did in a garden, and even though they didn't understand it at the time, it pointed forward to an even greater sacrifice to come. One day God would become one of them. He'd live faithfully under the covenant given at Sinai, and then he would die as the perfect sacrifice that all the other sacrifices pointed to. See, Jesus came to fulfill God's plan for restoring his presence on earth. That's why the prophet said that when he was born, he would be called Emmanuel, which means God with us, God present with us. Jesus would remove the barrier separating a sinful people from a holy God. By removing our sins, by washing us clean, Jesus ensures that one day God can come back and he can walk on earth with his people forever as his people enjoy his presence forever. The truth is the greatest gift God can give is himself, and in Jesus we receive that gift. A few years ago, John Piper wrote an excellent book called God is the Gospel. It's not hard to figure out what it's about. Right? The good news is God. In the book, he raises this excellent question. He said, the critical question for our generation and for every generation is this. If you could have heaven with no sickness, with all the friends you ever had on earth, with all and all the food you ever liked, and all the leisure activities you ever enjoyed, and all the natural beauties you ever saw, all the physical pleasures you ever tasted, and no human conflict or any natural disasters, could you be satisfied with heaven? if Christ were not there. You know, if you don't like pizza, then an invitation to an all-you-can-eat pizza buffet is no great gift to you. Especially if that buffet is an eternal buffet. The future for the followers of Jesus is all Jesus all the time. We get an eternal buffet of God in Christ. If Christ is not what satisfies you in this life, then heaven is no place for you. In that same book, Piper quotes J.C. Ryle, a sermon, in which he makes that point. He said, if your life isn't centered on Jesus now, what on earth are you going to do in heaven? What on earth are you going to do in the life to come if the life you live now is not a life focused on Jesus? See, gifts are supposed to be a reminder of the giver. My birthday was this last week. My wife and family gave me this really cool watch. I love the watch. But if I focused on the watch while ignoring my family, like if they meant nothing to me but the gift they gave me is all that I lived for, I would miss the point of the watch. I mean, the watch is cool. I love it. It's cool. But what I really love is my family who gave it to me because they loved me and they wanted to give me something I would enjoy, which reminds me of my family who is my real treasure. See, gifts are supposed to turn our focus not on the gift, but onto the giver of the gift. It's so easy for us to enjoy the blessings of God without God and to think that somehow having the blessing is enough. Look, any person who draws a breath without walking with God is a person who has rejected the giver of that very breath. To live without regard for God is to value God's gifts over God. There's a word for that. There is a word that describes what it is to value the thing rather than the giver of the thing, and that word is idolatry. I mean, where did Israel get the gold to make that calf? They got it from God. Instead of valuing God, the giver of the gold, they valued the gold and made a golden calf out of it and worshiped the gold. They worshiped the gift, ignoring the giver. We're not so different from Israel. See, it's easy for us to focus on the nice things God gives us and to forget the giver of the gift. The problem with only wanting the gift is it will never be enough. It will never satisfy because gifts are never meant to satisfy us. God created us to desire far more than just things. When we focus on the gift, our problem is that we desire too much. The problem is that we don't desire enough. What's greater than the good gifts he gives? The giver of the good gifts. If we're satisfied or think we're satisfied with the gifts, we've forgotten that there's something far greater. We were created to desire God. We were created to be satisfied by only him. Only he can satisfy us. In this life, he gives us glimpses of the life to come. But too often we focus on the gifts and think that what is to come, that is life with him forever, must somehow be insufficient or boring. This is, for example, why we might get upset with church, right? God has given us the church as the place where his presence is. Remember, each local church is the temple of God. That is, each local church, when we gather in his name, is the temple. It is where God's presence is on earth. We are the tabernacle in the wilderness of our culture. God is here, not out there. He's down the street at Creston. They are the tabernacle of God's presence in the wilderness of our culture. So is Berean. So is Fourth Reform. So is Coit. So is every church that preaches the gospel of Jesus. We are the tabernacle. Because of the work Jesus did for us, we can enter in behind the curtain, unlike Israel, and we can enjoy God's presence directly. Instead, we want to complain about music, or we want to complain about the preaching, probably legit. We want to complain about not being quite what we want it to be. Listen, the worship service is not intended to be the thing that satisfies you. If how we do worship here isn't quite how you want it done, that's okay. Be satisfied in Jesus. The only thing that is intended to satisfy you is God. You don't have to like the style of a particular song in order for the song to serve its purpose. The purpose of the song is to point you to Jesus. If it points you to Jesus, even though you don't like the style, great, it has served its purpose. Let the gifts God gives us point you to Jesus. Be satisfied in him. Your job is a gift from God, but it was never intended to be the thing that satisfies you. Your job is intended to point you to the greatness of our Savior. Look, every job has thorns and thistles, right? That's part of the curse. But those thorns and thistles, those grumpy bosses, those stupid TPS reports, those are meant to point you to the coming world in which Jesus reigns and God will dwell on earth as people forever, a world in which the curse, the thorns and thistles, is undone. That's what it's meant to point us toward. Forget the gift. Enjoy the giver of the gift. Your health is a gift from God, even if your health is bad, because your health is meant to point you to God. Don't trust in your health. It will fail you. I don't care how healthy you are right now. A time is coming when you won't be. Something's going to take your life, unless the Lord returns before then. Your health will fail you. Don't trust in the gift. Trust in what the gift is pointing you to, which is the giver of the gift. There's a reason an older believer can have incredible joy in Christ long after his youth and energy, long after his physical abilities have left him. It's because he knows that his joy and delight is found in Christ, not in his physical ability. Your financial situation is a gift from God. Whether your finances cause you to rejoice in God, who is generous beyond anything you can imagine, or your finances cause you to rejoice in God, who provides for all your needs. Some people live paycheck to paycheck. Some people live year to year, decade to decade. If your financial situation causes you to rejoice in God, then you are using the gift the way it was meant to be used, to point you to the giver of that gift. Your relationships are a gift from God. Whether you're single or married, whether you're father or mother or neither, whether you have lots of friends or few friends, they are meant to point you to God, the giver of those gifts. Enjoy your family. Enjoy your spouse if you have one. Enjoy your friends. Enjoy your children. But don't make relationships the thing that you live for. Let relationships with others point you to the one relationship that you were created to enjoy, the presence of God with you forever. The truth is, we are compelled by the beauty of Christ. Because God is with us in whatever circumstances we find ourselves, we can be deeply satisfied in him, even if the world around us is falling apart. That's how we can have joy in the midst of sorrow. A life built around God and his glory is a satisfying life. See, we don't want blessings. I mean, we do, but what we really want is Jesus. We want his presence with us. And the good news is that we already have it, and because we already have his presence, we have everything that is necessary for us to be filled with joy, regardless of our circumstances. We have the presence of God.